Welcome to Oncology Today, Optimal Utilization of PARP Inhibitors in Patients with Metastatic Prostate Cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Wasim Abida from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City to discuss this topic. To begin, I asked Dr. Abida to differentiate how he approaches patients with BRCA1 versus BRCA2 mutations.
We've often lumped BRCA2 and BRCA1 together. They do have complementary function, but it's clear that BRCA1 does not have the same oncogenic role as BRCA2 in prostate cancer. It actually makes sense in the germline susceptibility syndromes, right? We think of BRCA2, patients with BRCA2 inherited mutations, and having a higher risk of prostate and pancreatic cancer. But patients with BRCA1 germline mutations, typically that is breast and ovarian only. And what you see actually in the tumor itself is that patients who have BRCA1 deleterious mutations, which is much less common than BRCA2, often the BRCA1 gene is not fully lost. They retain a normal copy of BRCA1, whereas patients with BRCA2 mutated prostate cancer typically lose both copies of the genes, though they have complete loss of BRCA2. So that really points to BRCA2 being an important oncogenic event in prostate cancer, BRCA1 less so. So essentially, what we do see is that patients with BRCA1 mutations do not appear to benefit as much as patients with BRCA2 mutations. It is not as much of a relevant target in prostate cancer as BRCA2. And this is really the reason why the FDA only approved the combination of niraparib with abiraterone for patients with BRCA2 mutation. There is an increasing recognition that BRCA1 is not as sensitizing as BRCA2, and that really the focus should be BRCA2.
So I've had the impression that in ovarian and breast cancer, it seems pretty similar sensitivity to PARP.
Yep.
Is that the case? Why is it different in prostate cancer?
So we don't know why BRCA1 is not as important a DNA repair gene in prostate cancer as it is in breast and ovarian cancer. That's really not something we have an answer to just yet. But it is clear that in breast and ovarian cancer, when you do have a mutation in BRCA1, it represents complete loss of function of BRCA1. So it's an important oncogenic event in breast and ovarian cancer. In prostate cancer, when you harbor a mutation in BRCA1, it is more frequently a passenger mutation, just a random mutation that does not reflect complete loss of function of BRCA1. So a mutation of BRCA1 in prostate cancer often does not represent true homologous recombination repair deficiency. You need to have full loss of the gene in order to develop homologous recombination repair deficiency. And in prostate cancer, a BRCA1 mutation is more likely to represent a passenger or not a meaningful mutation. Now, that being said, if you ask me, I have a patient with a BRCA1 mutation, and I know that their likelihood of benefit is lower than a patient with a BRCA2 mutation. If you ask me if I would treat them with a PARP inhibitor, the answer is yes, I would. I don't know specifically if they will respond or not, but they may. The response rate is certainly going to be lower. It's going to be closer to 30 to 50% towards the 30% objective response rate. But that being said, they may still benefit. And so I would treat them. With time, we're going to have better biomarkers to figure out who's benefiting or not. Right now, the biomarker is, do you have a single mutation in a gene? Right now, that's our biomarker. That's actually not a great biomarker. There are genome-wide homologous recombination signatures that are starting to get reported in commercial NGS assays. So these signatures are looking specifically at homologous recombination repair deficiency, not just a mutation in a single gene. So you will get a score of this tumor looks like it harbors homologous recombination repair deficiency. So in time, I think we'll be able to distinguish BRCA1s who will benefit from BRCA1s who will not benefit from PARP inhibition. That's where we're headed right now.
I was going to ask you about it because, you know, in ovarian cancer, they have this LOH score, which I think is kind of what you were referring to.
That's exactly right. I never really understood,
like, what do they look at? They've talked to me about, like, scarring or something. What do you actually look at when you do this kind of score?
That's a great question. They're computationally derived scores. looking at specific changes throughout the genome that are characteristic of homologous recombination repair deficiency. So loss of heterozygosity, it really reflects copy number changes, so deletions and gains across the genome that are typical of homologous recombination repair deficiency. Because if you think about it, what BRCA2 mutation reflects is that the cell likely lost a gene that is critical for repairing DNA double-strand breaks. If a tumor has lost the BRCA2 gene completely and is unable to repair these double-strand breaks, it'll start to accumulate these characteristic alterations across their genome, which you can think of as a scar across the genome. And what these LOH scores calculate is they do come up with a threshold or a cutoff to say, this tumor looks like it's accumulated enough bizarreness across the genome, enough copy number changes throughout the genome, that it's likely deficient in homologous recombination repair. So that gives you an extra look at the genome beyond a single mutation in a gene such as BRCA2 or BRCA1. I think it will be helpful to answer specifically your question, you know, what about BRCA2 versus BRCA1? Well, right now we're just looking at a single mutation, one of these genes. But this is in a way, it's a functional look at the genome.
That's really helpful. I've asked a lot of the gynecologic people, and I never understood it, but that really helped me out a lot. We're actually getting ready to go to the SGO meeting in Puerto Rico this week, and maybe as long as you explain that to me, you can explain why is it. I see these cases where they send a tissue, again, I know it's ovary, but I'm curious, for the LOH score, and they'll like send it three times, and they, quote, can't do it. Do you know what's going on there?
I'll just speak more generally about this kind of testing. So the test failures do happen, and with NGS, and much of it really has to do with DNA quality. What we've looked actually at NGS to look specifically for BRCA mutations and other types of alterations, the age of the tumor matters. Now, for prostate cancer, that's particularly relevant because, as you know, the timeline from diagnosis until metastasis can be quite long. So the older the sample, the higher the likelihood of failing NGS in general, not just for LOH scores, but in general. And so in general, we prefer to send a tumor when it's 3 years or less in age, because DNA does tend to degrade over time, particularly if the tissue was not fixed properly. And what's the other thing that's very important is tumor content in the sample. So how much of the sample has actual tumor cells versus normal cells? It is particularly tricky with looking at copy number changes. So if you're looking for deletions across the genome, if you have a tumor sample that has very little tumor content, if you have a tumor, you know, specimen that has very few tumor cells relative to normal, you're not going to be able to call deletions or loss of certain alleles as well. And LOH scores are predominantly based on these kind of copy number changes across the genome. So tumor quality can be important when you're trying to call those kinds of changes. And so there are quality control thresholds that would say if your sample doesn't have sufficient tumor content, we will not be able to give you an LOH score, or we won't be able to call certain alterations. This is especially true if you're sending a plasma sample. So it's one thing to send a tumor sample. It's almost always going to have enough tumor cells. On occasion, it will not have it. For example, prostate cancer and bone biopsies. Bone biopsies from prostate cancer notoriously have a high failure rate. We are seeing more and more plasma testing, as I'm sure you've discussed with some other colleagues. When you don't have tissue, you send plasma. And you're really banking on there being enough circulating tumor DNA in that plasma relative to whatever normal DNA has been spilled and contaminates the sample. As it happens, sometimes you just have a very low amount of circulating tumor DNA. And so it's very difficult to call LOH scores, because it's very hard to tell if you've lost a copy of an allele or of your genome in a sample that has very little tumor DNA.
That's really helpful. Another question relates to PALB2. I don't hear that talked about too much. I've heard that called BRCA3, just sort of jokingly. But how often do you see that in prostate cancer?
It's
and
rare.
How sensitive has that? And, but yes. If you do see it, is it kind of like BRCA in terms of response to PARP?
It looks like it. And the reason I say it looks like it, and the reason you haven't heard that much about it, is because it's very uncommon. It's a less than 1% event. What's interesting about BRCA2 is that, unlike breast and ovarian, BRCA2 and prostate cancer can happen in the tumor only. It can happen somatically. A prostate cancer tumor, half the time, will have inherited a BRCA2 mutant allele, and the other half is really just a sporadic event that doesn't run in families, which is really unusual for prostate. I mean, relative to breast and ovarian, where predominantly it's an inherited event. PALB2 in prostate cancer is typically inherited. It's very rare. It's a less than 1% event. And it looks like it does sensitize as well as BRCA2 to PARP inhibitors. But because we don't have that many numbers, we can't say for sure. But if I am going to counsel a patient who has a BRCA2 germline mutation on PARP inhibitor and likely response, I would say the likelihood of benefit is high, probably just as good as BRCA2 is the estimate right now.
So another thing I'm curious about is what's happening in terms of genetic counseling for patients with prostate cancer. I've kind of been thinking and hoping that it was going to get a lot more online, so it'd be easier to access genetic counselors. What's Yep. going on in that respect? And in general, how do you approach referrals for genetic counseling?
So that's a great question. So genetic testing has become really applicable to, I would say, you know, if not the majority, then soon the majority of men with prostate cancer in general. So the NCCN guidelines now recommend genetic testing for all men with metastatic prostate cancer. Anybody with metastatic prostate cancer should have genetic counseling, genetic testing, just like all women with ovarian cancer. And really for a large proportion of men with localized disease as well. So men with high risk localized prostate cancer, the advice is genetic testing. And those men are really predominantly seen in the urology clinics, right? Or by radiation oncologists, for instance. Men with family history, men with personal history of another BRCA-like cancer, and men with Ashkenazi ancestry. The recommendation for all of those men, regardless of actually the risk of prostate cancer, is to undergo genetic testing. So that's a large proportion of men diagnosed with prostate cancer nowadays. Unfortunately, only a minority are actually getting the genetic counseling and genetic testing. I think there needs to be more education, really, especially among colleagues in urology who are very busy surgeons, right, to talk about genetic testing. In general, what I would say is the testing itself has become quite simple. You know, the guidelines recommend it for most men with prostate cancer. There are not enough genetic counselors out there to do that type of pre-test counseling for the 300,000 plus men, you know, with prostate cancer in the United States each year. There just aren't enough. So really, the burden's falling on the clinicians who are seeing and treating these patients, the urologists, the radiation oncologists, and certainly the medical oncologists. We do the pretest consent. We order the genetic testing for our patients with prostate cancer in the medical oncology clinics. Once they have, if they have a mutation, then we refer them to our genetic counseling colleagues for discussion of the implications, for cascade testing, and so on and so forth. So I think that's a reasonable way, because we can't refer all of our patients to genetic counselors. There just aren't enough out there.
I was just wondering whether or not actually people, I mean, I think genetic testing is one thing, but in terms of genetic counseling, I don't know how accessible that is, particularly in person. That's why I was saying that I was hoping that we'd see a lot more online counseling, but are you seeing that happening?
There is very little online counseling, you know, outside of your usual telemedicine visit. I think that the burden, unfortunately, falls to the medical oncologist to do it right now. And frankly, we all know that a lot of people just have not been trained to do it. Some states are very actually quite explicit in the fact that patients need to have adequate counseling before you order the testing, because it has implications for relatives. Unfortunately, I've not seen a lot of genetic counseling happening online, and it is a shame. It has become easier, though, for patients to self-trigger that testing. There are commercial entities where you can order a kit, saliva kit online. It's kind of written counseling, I guess. It's not person to person. it's not perfect because, you know, patients are not able to speak to somebody before they do the testing themselves. And of course, they have to find a doctor who's able to interpret the findings adequately for them. So it's available, but the counseling could be better. I think it's really just a lot of physicians need to be educated on interpreting the results so that when a patient comes in with one of these reports, they're able to interpret it properly for their patients.
So another thing that you talked about that I wanted to ask you about is a toxicity of PARP inhibitor, particularly hematologic. One of the things I was noticing, and I don't know, I just never really noticed it before, is, you know, when you say olaparib, people bring up anemia, but yet indirectly, when you showed the data there, it looked like the other PARP inhibitors caused at least as much, if not more. So I'm just kind of curious what your experience is with anemia in these patients, particularly those who have a lot of metastatic disease. How much of an issue is it?
It's a real issue. I counsel my patients that we likely will get grade 3 anemia, so requiring transfusion about a quarter to a third of the time. And this is true across the, you know, PARP inhibitors that we use. To be honest, when we first started using PARP inhibitors, I was learning from my colleagues who treated ovarian cancer because they had approvals with more than one PARP inhibitor before we had any approval, right, starting with olaparib and so on. And they had experience with niraparib. So now we have four PARP inhibitors approved, either as monotherapy or a combination for prostate cancer. And then we've got a fifth one, saruparib, which is currently in phase 3 trials. So we've got four approved, one on the way. What I would say is that some of these PARP inhibitors have better PARP trapping effect or PARP 1 specificity, which in theory should reduce the toxicity. But in practical experience, all the PARP inhibitors have similar toxicities. You know, there's not a huge difference. The ones that are more potent, the doses are much lower. Look at the dose of talazoparib. It's 0.5 milligrams a day in combination with enzalutamide versus olaparib, 600 milligrams twice daily. Right? The drug is, you know, possibly 1,000 times more potent. However, you take 1,000 times lower dose on a daily basis. Right. So ultimately, the toxicities are generally comparable. Counseling patients on toxicities of PARP inhibitors is actually pretty straightforward. It's really repetitive. It's a myelosuppression, predominantly anemia, grade 3 anemia, with some risk of neutropenia and low platelets as well, but really anemia by and large. It's, of course, the risk of secondary malignancies, which is quite small, but it does exist. And lastly, it's really GI toxicities, the anorexia and the nausea, which we really see as a class effect across these drugs. The secondary malignancies, I don't want to understate those. That's always the concern about using these PARP inhibitors earlier and earlier. We recently had an approval for using niraparib in newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer. Now, median survival for men with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer is somewhere between 5 to 10 years, I'm pushing like 7 to 8 years probably at this point. So you're expecting these patients to be on these drugs for years, right? So we certainly do think about the long-term toxicities. The other thing to point out is that at this point, we have patients with prostate cancer who are receiving radioligand therapies, and that may move earlier and earlier. And there, if you've got a patient who received radioligand therapy followed by a PARP inhibitor, we will expect more toxicities. And it's almost a given. That's not happened yet because PARP inhibitors right now are still standard of care drugs and generally speaking used before radioligand therapies, before beta and alpha emitters.
Yeah, you know, again, outside of prostate cancer, when people start talking about more prolonged courses of PARP inhibitors, they get very nervous about AMDS and AML. I'm kind of curious, you know, now coming into the castrate-sensitive situation, as you mentioned, yeah. Are you planning on using it indefinitely,
yes.
Or do you get nervous if the patient's older? Are there any bone marrow findings that make you nervous?
Absolutely. Without a doubt, I do get nervous. I mean, the tricky thing about using these drugs earlier is, you know, it's, to be honest, I mixed feelings about it because there's certainly the potential for more toxicity. And the primary endpoints that are used are PFS, progression-free survival endpoints, compared with really a control arm that is just an ARPI alone. Now, the question is that really going to be beneficial versus using the drug sequentially? I mean, the standard of care has been use ADT plus ARPI first, and then when a patient with a BRCA2 mutation progresses, then you switch and give them a PARP inhibitor monotherapy. So it's the using PFS as the primary endpoint for earlier use of a drug in and of itself is not convincing enough, in my opinion. This is why there's a key secondary endpoint of overall survival, and there's the niraparib study Amplitude showed a trend towards improved overall survival from using PARP inhibitor plus ARPI combination up front. The other reason that kind of compels me in a fit patient to give them the combination is that the PFS really is quite impressive. It's a very long PFS. It's more than I would expect, you know, by using the drugs in sequence. And it kind of fits with that, with the earlier use of a drug being beneficial, right? We used to give ARPIs later. Now we give them combination up front. But certainly I do pay attention to the patient's fitness. I do pay attention to their marrow function when I'm going to start a PARP inhibitor. And that does dictate how aggressive I want to be up front. There's no doubt about this.
So you mentioned in terms of cytopenias, and I think I saw that on the chart you put out there. And again, going back to ovarian cancer, you have this issue of niraparib and thrombocytopenia. They ended up modifying their dose of the drug. And again, now you have niraparib in the hormone-sensitive yes. space. Do you see more thrombocytopenia with niraparib?
That's a great question. That actually came up as I was discussing with my ovarian colleagues who had experience with niraparib well before we did. Niraparib is the one drug, if you ask me about the distinction, is it does look like it's associated with more thrombocytopenia than the other three PARP inhibitors. The approvals for niraparib were more recent than olaparib and rucaparib for prostate cancers. So I would say for prostate cancer in general, we have less experience with niraparib than with the other drugs. In CRPC, we've tended to give it less, much less, as a matter of fact. Now, that may change. So, because it's the only drug that has an approval in newly diagnosed metastatic disease currently, it's the only PARP inhibitor. So, I've not seen substantial thrombocytopenia yet, but it is a concern, right? Because it's been reported to have more thrombocytopenia than the other drugs.
So also you mentioned this a newer PARP inhibitor, saruparib. Can you talk a little bit about how it differs from the other PARP inhibitors we have out here? Do we see any difference, either efficacy or tolerability? And also mm-hmm. I see not only are they looking at hormone-sensitive metastatic disease, but earlier as post-radiation sure. therapy. Absolutely. Can you talk about that as well?
Saruparib was designed to be specific to PARP-1. So there are three PARP enzymes, PARP-1, PARP-2, PARP-3, they have complementary function. PARP-1 is the predominant enzyme involved in single-strand break repair. And this drug was designed to specifically target PARP-1 significantly, much more specifically than PARP-2 and PARP-3, with the hypothesis that that would end up having less toxicity than PARP inhibitors that target all three PARP enzymes. It's not clear that really the toxicity, if you look kind of across the studies, it seems to have similar toxicities. It's the drug that's being developed. It's hard, of course, to compare across studies, but it does look like it has, you know, kind of a 20% grade 3 anemia rate, sort of in line with some of the other PARP inhibitors. But it has moved along into phase 3 studies. The first one of those phase 3 studies is in newly diagnosed metastatic disease. It's called EvoPAR-01. And as you mentioned, another phase 3 study is looking at saruparib even earlier than that. It's adjuvant after radiation, so for patients with high-risk localized prostate cancer. So high-risk localized prostate cancer, patients would get long-term hormone therapy. So this phase 3 study is using saruparib in the adjuvant setting. After completion of radiation, patients would either get a placebo or would add saruparib to their long-term hormone therapy, with the idea that these patients are particularly high risk for recurrence if they have a BRCA2, BRCA1 mutation. There's some long-term outcomes data. and that the addition of a PARP inhibitor up front would improve cure rates. So that's what that study is looking at and actively enrolling globally.
Can you comment a little bit about how you're thinking through the newly diagnosed patient or the patient with hormone sensitive? I forget the new name. I know you were on the big paper with all the new terminology.
It's worth mentioning the new nomenclature, I think. I should be using that in presentations at this point. For two reasons. Number one, the term castration, I think, has always been appropriately unpopular with patients and physicians. And we've been talking for a long time about moving away from that term, which can be distressing for, you know, men to hear. And then the second one is really that the landscape has changed so much that the term hormone-sensitive, castration-sensitive, castration-resistant really doesn't apply anymore. So the term is moved to talk about androgen pathway modulator, APM, either naive, so never been treated, APMN, androgen pathway modulator sensitive, APMS, meaning the patient is on ADT or an RP or both, and is sensitive to those, or androgen pathway modulator resistant, APMR. So it's really APMN, completely naive to any hormone, APMS, sensitive to hormone therapy, or APMR, which is resistant to hormone therapy. Those are really the three terms. How do I think about a newly diagnosed, a man with newly diagnosed metastatic prostate cancer? So metastatic APMN, androgen pathway modulator naive prostate cancer. Well, I mean, the first thing I do is, of course, I start the patient on ADT alone, right? I order their NGS. I order their next generation sequencing right away. Pretty much the day that I meet the patient, it takes a few weeks to get the result back. Either way, all patients are really adding on an RP at diagnosis at this point. You've got you can start them on darolutamide, abiraterone, enzalutamide, or apalutamide. Any of these are appropriate. But I like to wait for a couple of reasons. I like to wait because, number one, I want to get the NGS results back. Because as we know, there are combination options depending on which, if the patient has a BRCA2 mutation, for example, I may favor giving them abiraterone with niraparib. So I'll wait those few weeks, number one, for the patient to get settled really on androgen deprivation therapy, and number two, to get the NGS results back. Because if they have a BRCA2 mutation, I would be inclined to give them abiraterone plus niraparib. If there's a trial option, certainly I would look at a trial option. For example, there is a phase 3 study called Aspire right now that's trying to definitively answer the question of whether the addition of docetaxel as triplet therapy is appropriate. We've always said, well, if you're high volume, we should think of being more aggressive, but we really don't know if the addition of docetaxel to a doublet hormonal regimen is beneficial. So there's a phase 3 randomized study trying to ask that question. You get ADT plus apalutamide or ADT APA plus docetaxel. So really what I do is I try to figure out, first of all, if a patient has a mutation, that they should be getting a niraparib plus abiraterone. Or if they don't have a mutation, I would look at either a hormonal doublet or this trial comparing a chemotherapy triplet to a hormonal doublet.
I didn't really think about it. So can you give docetaxel plus niraparib in this hormone-sensitive setting?
You cannot. It's pretty toxic. You have to choose. For a patient with BRCA2 mutation, I would always go for the triplet that has the targeted therapy. I would always go for the niraparib combination.
Incidentally, in your workup, you mentioned the NGS takes a while. Do you send liquid if you see it positive there, treat?
I always send tissue when I have tissue, without a doubt. The sensitivity
not
is
both.
Better. Not
both?
Usually both. I usually would send liquid if I don't have recent tissue or if I don't have adequate tissue. That's when I said liquid. Liquid is highly, it's highly sensitive to the tumor burden. Most men don't have enough tumor burden really to find certain kinds of mutations. A BRCA deletion, for example, is very difficult to detect on liquid. Certainly, I wouldn't send liquid after starting a patient on treatment. So if I see a patient who just started ADT a month ago, you know, they're going to be responding pretty quickly. Their burden of circulating tumor DNA is likely going to be pretty low, and that report might come back blank without any mutations, just because it's so liquid testing, although it's extremely useful, it is highly dependent on circulating tumor burden.
Yeah, you know, we actually just did a webinar recently with your colleague Andy Armstrong from Duke, who I guess is in mourning now because his basketball team just lost. But one of the things that we were getting into, I don't know if you have, I know there are a lot of new terminologies, but there's another sort of concept. I don't know whether there's a name for it or not. I mean, at least an abbreviation. It's the idea of PSMA-only Mets. Mm-hmm. This came out, you know, with the EMBARK study. And we're seeing more and more patients who are being, particularly those who are being followed, and they're picked up very early. So when you think about your algorithm for now androgen pathway modulator sensitive situation, do you still use a PARP inhibitor if they have limited disease and PSMA only disease?
That's a great question. So, you know, so far the studies have not counted PSMA-only disease, so that disease that shows up only on a PET scan and doesn't have a correlate on CT or on a technetium bone scan. So most studies have not counted that as really metastatic disease, even though it actually is. So, you know, there's a lot of, this applies beyond just niraparib usage. There's a lot of context where it's kind of open to interpretation. How aggressive do you want to be when the metastatic disease is visible on PET only? And my answer is yes, we do have a lot of latitude. And in general, if I see multifocal disease on a PSMA PET, particularly if a PSA is going up quickly, that is high-risk disease. That is aggressive disease. It's metastatic. Right. Either way, I think we can all agree this is metastatic disease. This is the incurable disease that has spread. So I would tend to treat it more aggressively. Now, on the flip side, if I see oligometastatic disease, whether it's on a PET only or on a CT, I may be more inclined to treat it, you know, less aggressively. So, a slow PSA doubling time. We even have in the guidelines would consider metastasis-directed therapy in that context, so radiation with the aim of delaying systemic therapy and its associated toxicity. So the answer is for now, because the studies have not counted PET-only disease as actual metastatic, we have a lot of latitude. So, you know, that latitude for me means if it looks like this is aggressive multifocal disease, I treat it as such.
All right, well, let's get into your cases and get more into some of the clinical things that come up with these patients. We'll start out with this 74-year-old man. What happened with him?
Sure. So this is actually a patient of mine, 74 years old, has a history of hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and GERD, otherwise quite fit. He presented to me in 2017. His PSA was about 40, and he had de novo metastatic disease, so what we call APMN, androgen pathway modulator, naive disease at the time. He had pelvic and retroperitoneal lymph nodes, and he had two lesions on a bone scan. So we would generally call him low volume metastatic spread at the time. His biopsy of the prostate showed Gleason 4+5 adenocarcinoma. At the time, I sent NGS on his prostate tumor biopsy, and it showed a BRCA2 rearrangement. So that is a deleterious alteration. This was back in 2017. At the time, we had zero PARP inhibitor approvals for prostate cancer in any setting. I started him on treatment with ADT and abiraterone and prednisone. That was a, you know, standard care based on the latitude study at the time. And he had radiation to the prostate as well, per the Stampede study. So a fairly aggressive upfront treatment at the time. His PSA, he responded really great. PSA nadir was undetectable, complete radiographic response in the lymph nodes. But after 18 months of hormones, he really was not enjoying, you know, the toxicities, the cumulative fatigue, the muscle loss, the loss of libido, and wanted to take a break from treatment. So he stopped ADT and abiraterone and prednisone after 18 months, so sometime in 2018, 2019. So after a year and a half, he took a break from ADT and abiraterone and prednisone. His PSA remained undetectable, but his testosterone never recovered. It stayed below 59 grams per deciliter, so remained castrate even though he was on a break. By 2025, his PSA rose up to 2.0. By definition, this was castration-resistant prostate cancer, what we call androgen pathway modulator-resistant disease, because his testosterone remained low, and his PSMA PET showed a single bone lesion. So just as we had discussed, you know, this was a patient who had progression but oligoprogression on a PSMA PET scan, so we gave him SBRT, He responded for some time. His PSA declined, but by 2026, his PSA rose again up to 5.0 with a bone scan and a PSMA PET showing multifocal bone metastasis. So based on that, it was really time to resume systemic therapy. So I resumed ADT and initiated abiraterone prednisone with olaparib at this time. So this is a patient, pretty uncommon scenario at this point, because it's first-line metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer. Most men in this scenario would still be on an ARPI, but he opted to go on a break many years ago, and his testosterone remained castrate. So this is a rare scenario of a first-line metastatic CRPC patient where we've got three options for combination of ARPI plus a PARP inhibitor. I opted for abiraterone with olaparib because he was already familiar with abiraterone. So I often will just rechallenge a patient who's already had a drug with the same drug just based on familiarity, both for the patient and myself with the toxicities that they experience. And here you've got approval for abiraterone prednisone with olaparib per the PROPEL study. And so jumping onto the next slide, I just want to show his PSA curve and his testosterone. So this goes back just a few years to 2021. You can see his PSA in the blue line was undetectable for quite some time. His testosterone level stayed steadily at castrate level. That's in the pink line. And what you can see here is that by 2025, his PSA began to rise with the testosterone remaining still castrate. That's when it rose up to 2 with oligoprogression in the spot of the bone. SBRT alone dropped that PSA for some time, but a year later that PSA started to go up again. He had multifocal progression, and then you can see his PSA decline since resuming ADT plus abiraterone plus olaparib. So this is really a case of first-line metastatic CRPC with a BRCA2 deleterious alteration.
And how long has he been on treatment now with the olaparib and any tolerability issues?
So far, the only tolerability issues is experienced is with olaparib, frankly. We all know the hypertension issues that can be difficult to manage with olaparib sometimes. This is a recurrent issue that, you know, we had with this particular gentleman who, when he went on the break from olaparib, came off all antihypertensive. When he goes back on olaparib, his blood pressure goes up, and we have to do some blood pressure management. Fairly typical, I think. Most medical oncologists now who have experience giving this drug are pretty well versed with the blood pressure and LFT management that comes along with this particular drug. So he's only been on it for a couple of months. This was 2026.
Great case. You know, I was going to ask you also before we continue, we can just, while I'm thinking about it, before we go into your next case, sure. You had mentioned in your last slide the idea of combining PARP inhibitors with other DNA repair inhibitors. Mm-hmm. Like what kind of other DNA inhibitors are being looked at?
Sure. So there's at least one, if not two, active phase. These are all phase ones, by the way. The idea, I want to take a step back. The rationale for this is that all tumor cells inherently have some DNA repair deficiency. A subset of tumor cells, of course, particularly those that harbor mutations in BRCA2, have a significant deficiency in homologous recombination repair, so enough that they will be sensitized to PARP inhibition at the doses that we give the drug, at the doses that these drugs are tolerable. But other tumor cells may have kind of, you know, a lower level of homologous recombination repair deficiency, not enough to respond to a PARP inhibitor alone, certainly not at tolerable doses of those PARP inhibitors. But potentially, if you combine a PARP inhibitor with another agent that inhibits DNA repair, and if that's tolerable, you may cross the threshold and causing enough damage to the tumor DNA versus a normal cell damage, that you would kill the tumor cell. So that's really the hypothesis, that you would really push these tumor cells over the edge because they certainly are more sensitive to DNA repair inhibition compared with normal cells. And so, first of all, there's been trials before looking at combining PARP inhibitors with chemotherapy, really to cause more DNA damage in the cell. That's very toxic. And that was in ovarian cancer. I mean, combining PARP inhibitor with platinum drug, just not doable. It's very toxic. We have interesting data now showing actually safety of combining PARP inhibitors with radioligand therapy in prostate cancer. So lutetium PSMA, a beta emitter, which is really a DNA damaging agent, coupled with a PARP inhibitor is safe. And so that really may be a promising avenue to treat prostate cancers beyond BRCA deficient or beyond HR deficient. You may really potentiate the effect of the beta emitter by adding a PARP inhibitor. So it's safe in phase one, and it's likely going to move along farther along in looking at efficacy sometime in the near future. And then there are novel agents. For example, there is a DNA repair pathway called microhomology repair, and that is parallel to homologous recombination repair. And there are phase one studies in process right now looking at combining PARP inhibitor with a key effector of this DNA repair pathway called microhomology mediated repair called POLQ. So a combination of POLQ inhibition with PARP inhibition. There's also DNA-PK. It's another DNA repair pathway. So these are really enzymes that are very specifically involved in specific subtypes of DNA repair, where the combination with PARP inhibitor may be effective, so long as it's tolerable. That's really the key, because the more you add these drugs affecting DNA repair, you're likely going to cause some damage to normal cells as well.
So actually, I was going to ask you about PSMA addition trial using lutetium, again, in the, I'm still going to call it, hormone-sensitive metastatic disease setting. First of all, I'm just curious what you thought about it. Would you like to be able to use that strategy? But also, what about combining lutetium with olaparib or with a PARP inhibitor as well, just to get more tumor effect? And also what you're saying in terms of maybe having a synergistic effect, is that something you'd like to do?
Well, yeah, I'll start with the second question first. The combination of PARP inhibitor with lutetium makes total sense. We know that it's actually a phase one study's been reported. It's safe to do that. It's tolerable, unlike combination of PARP inhibitor with chemotherapy, for instance. And it's likely going to really move along into randomized studies looking at efficacy of lutetium alone, which is really a standard of care, versus lutetium plus olaparib in all comers, right, to potentiate the effect of lutetium across men with metastatic prostate cancer, not just those with BRCA2, BRCA1 mutations. So I think that's going to move along. I'm certainly curious to see the result. I think it's a very promising avenue in treating unselected prostate cancer, really potentiate the effect of the beta emitter. With regards to using lutetium PSMA up front, that's really difficult. I mean, certainly there is a progression-free survival benefit by adding lutetium. The question comes back to, what is the risk versus benefit? Again, the PFS is up front. It doesn't tell you if that this is superior to using the drug sequentially. Currently, the standard of care is a patient starts with ADT plus an ARPI, and then when they progress, they can get lutetium PSMA per PSMA-4. And so, you know, I'd like to see, and I think the FDA would like to see, some sign that OS is trending in the right direction as well, before we see an approval and common use of, you know, lutetium PSMA in the upfront setting. I think this is true of all upfront use of drugs. With niraparib as well, the thing that makes me lean towards giving niraparib upfront with abiraterone for BRCA2 patients is that there is a trend towards improved overall survival beyond just the PFS benefit, right? It does look like there is an overall benefit to the patient, which is really the key here.
All right, let's hear about your 64-year-old man.
Sure. So another patient of mine, 64 years old with a history of hypertension, erectile dysfunction, and GERD. He does have Ashkenazi background, and his mother had breast cancer at age 68. He was found to have a PSA of 30 on routine screening, underwent imaging showing multifocal bone metastases and biopsy of the prostate showing Gleason 4+5 prostate adenocarcinoma with cribriform morphology, which is a morphologic finding that is associated with higher risk of BRCA mutations. That's actually worth pointing out that is a histologic finding that should trigger DNA testing. So he initiates ADT with abiraterone and prednisone, and subsequently we get germline testing results come back with a pathogenic BRCA2 germline mutation, which certainly falls in line with his Ashkenazi background, mother with breast cancer, and the cribriform morphology on his prostate biopsy. And so this patient, and this was really very recent, we added niraparib 200 milligrams daily as a combination with abiraterone acetate per amplitude study, which we just, as we just discussed, had a PFS benefit and OS that trends towards improved overall survival, and that data is still maturing at this point. It's too soon for me to comment on kind of toxicity and outcomes because this was all very recent. The approval itself, as a matter of fact, was very recent for this combination. I should add that really the FDA approval is for a combination pill that combines niraparib with abiraterone and acetate from J&J, not for the drugs given separately.
Just out of curiosity, how does this man think through family members and the implication there?
That's a good question. So we certainly, this is, you know, coming back to the question of genetic counseling, this is where I, as a medical oncologist, refer patients to genetic counselors to have the discussion. You know, they'll go through a very careful family tree and we'll discuss with the patient really the cascade testing and offer cascade testing to blood relatives on a case-by-case basis. You know, depending, you know, unfortunately, a lot of my patients like this one, for example, will have lost contact with family members. And, it, you know, it's a lost opportunity to bring these family members at risk, right, to have genetic testing and really more intensive screening wherever appropriate when their testing comes back positive.
Let's hear about the 61-year-old man.
Sure. So this is also a patient of mine. So 61 years old. He has a history of hypertension, otherwise quite healthy, presented with back pain, and he had CT, a diagnosis showing diffuse bone metastases and lymphadenopathy. His PSA came back at about a 500, so very high volume disease at diagnosis. And he had a biopsy of a retroperitoneal lymph node that showed metastatic prostate cancer. We did NGS on that retroperitoneal node that showed really only two mutations, but both were truncating mutations in CDK12. And I'll come back to kind of that particular finding. So we started him on ADT with darolutamide alone at that point. Not even, I did not give him triplet therapy with docetaxel. He was kind of resistant to get more aggressive therapy, was working full time. He had a great response, PSA nadir'd at 0.07, excellent radiographic response, but then really had a short interval until PSA rise. So 18 months, until he was starting to develop signs of resistance, PSA going up to 5.0, a CT that looked stable, but bone scan that started to show some slight increase in uptake in some of the bone lesions. So really, after about 18 months, starting to develop resistance to ADT plus darolutamide. And so the question is, what do we do at that point? Do I start him on docetaxel? Do I put him on lutetium PSMA, which is approved for patients with first-line, you know, what we call androgen pathway modulator resistant disease at this point? But he did have the CDK12 mutations. And we saw, I presented results from the TALAPRO2 study, first-line metastatic CRPC. Now, the caveat is, again, TALAPRO2 mostly included patients who did not have a prior RP. This patient had a prior RP. He was on darolutamide and progressing. But what was interesting in that study is that patients with CDK12 mutations looked to benefit from the combination of enzalutamide plus talazoparib. This patient was inclined to try something less aggressive. And so I thought, well, let's see if we can get some control of his disease by switching from darolutamide to give him enzalutamide plus talazoparib, which is really an approved combination given his CDK12 mutation. And this is exactly what we did. Now, it's a little hard to say, but you can see that his PSA initially did respond. And this is really more of a discussion case, not really necessarily to push people one way or another. But I wanted to see what would happen for in this particular patient. He's tolerated fantastically. You can see that his PSA dropped. But, you know, the last PSA we checked was starting to show, an up curve there. So the question is he going to get durable benefit out of this combination or not? We know that crossing over from one RP to another, by the way, you could see transient benefits. So daro to enza alone could be explaining this. At this point, I don't know. But just to show that really this is a combination option, particularly for RP-naive patients who have CDK12 mutations. Now, CDK12 is particularly interesting. It is a it's mutated in 6% of men with metastatic prostate cancer. So that's not insignificant. I mean, 6% of patients will have it. Often they will have two mutations in the same gene, which is really almost unheard of. They'll have, if we've got two alleles of CDK12, often you'll have a mutation in each allele. So it really shows you that there's a strong disposition to mutate CDK12, a strong biological basis to knock it out, to lose it in the tumor. And it has real function in the tumor cell. The issue is we don't really understand the function of CDK12 too well. It's not a homologous recombination repair gene. So it is a gene that we're trying to target. Actually, we're trying to target this disease subset. We've been trying to do it with different pathways. Initially, there was some indication that they might benefit from immune checkpoint blockade. That turned out, unfortunately, to be quite disappointing. That's been a phase two study that was published, led by at the University of Michigan. But we certainly are trying. But this was here my clinical try to see if I could achieve control of this disease with enzalutamide plus dalazoparib.
I see this patient progressed after 18 months.
Yes. So, you know, at the same time, so CDK12 is more commonly associated with metastatic disease at diagnosis and some worse outcomes compared with men without CDK12 mutations, which we've published on, subsequently others have published on as well. So it is associated with some worse outcome, although the most striking clinical observations, most men with CDK12 mutations present with metastatic disease at diagnosis. And this is a little bit anecdotal for this point, because for this patient, particularly because he actually has had a very high volume disease at diagnosis, right? PSA 500, a diffuse metastasis to the bone. So certainly high volume. The question then becomes really, is the genomic alteration independently prognostic, independently of other clinical factors that are there? We couldn't tell you because it's a single case, but certainly CDK12 mutations are associated with more de novo metastatic disease, which it tends to be, right? De novo metastatic disease is typically higher volume than recurrent metastatic disease. So really it certainly fits the picture for these patients.
This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. And please note that the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed in this program, so check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Dr. Abita, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Optimal Utilization of PARP Inhibitors in Patients with Metastatic Prostate Cancer.